Gearing up for D-Day's big anniversary, today, Thursday, June 5th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. Tomorrow will be 70 years since Allied forces stormed the beaches of Normandy, but the power of that day still resonates. This British vet returned this year to remember a buddy he lost.
Well, Sheriff Jack Daniels, I'm going back there for the last time just to pour a bit on his grave and I'll have the rest.
Also D-Day then and now through one photographer's lens, and we'll hear how D-Day is remembered in Moscow, and later why we should care that a million people are at risk of famine in South Sudan.
That's like more than the population of San Francisco, at risk of starving to death.
Plus, an Iranian woman's magazine is back 6 years after being shut down.
I think this is a beautiful opening act, and it also shows the art of persistence.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. Most of us know something about D-Day from history class. At least I hope most of us do. The Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944, helped shape the world and the United States as we know them right now. But there are still a few out there who lived D-Day. And today, hundreds of the last surviving veterans of the invasion began commemorating its 70th anniversary.
We are gathered here today to remember and give thanks for the lives of the men of the Glider Pilot Regiment. Let us pray.
That's from a ceremony today in Portsmouth, England, where many U.S. and British troops gathered 70 years ago to prepare for the mission. It was a massive operation involving more than 150,000 Allied troops. Over 4,000 are now thought to have died on the first day of the invasion. But the assault on Nazi-occupied France would eventually turn the tide of World War II. We'll look at that war from both European fronts, East and West, in a few minutes. We start, though, with reporter Jake Seganero, who sent us this story from Normandy.
A crowd of schoolchildren waving French and U.S. flags welcomes a procession of World War II veterans escorted by soldiers. This town, Lacombe, is just 10 miles inland from Omaha Beach. Today, it's unveiling a new plaque honoring D-Day veterans. Just one of many events slated to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Normandy landings. The entire coastal region has been preparing for months for the arrival of world leaders, veterans, tourists, and war buffs. They're coming to pay tribute to the soldiers who fought and gave their lives. Even today, caretakers of the German cemetery just outside of Lacombe were mowing the grounds in final preparation for the swarms of visitors. 7 decades after the Allies landed, this is likely the last major commemoration for many who lived D-Day.
The years have gone by. You know, some of us are more lucky than others.
British veteran Les Dobinson came to honor his fallen comrades. Dobinson was taken out of his flying squad at the last minute before the invasion. The roommate who took his place in the operation was killed. Dobinson is now 89, and he plans to say a final goodbye to his friend who's buried here.
Well, Sheriff Jack Daniels. Because that's the last time I saw him. He brought when I was in sick bay, he brought me a drink. So I'm going back there for the last time just to pour a bit on his grave and I'll have the rest.
No one else from Dobinson's flight training group survived.
I'm the last one.
91-year-old American veteran James Kunkel served in the U.S. Air Force, but he says the true heroes of D-Day were the ground troops. For Kunkel, this week is more than just a remembrance. It's a reunion. He's staying with the family of the Frenchman he befriended during his service 70 years ago.
And I didn't speak French and he didn't speak English and I called him Monsieur Papa.
After losing touch for 6 decades, Kunkel found the family again 5 years ago with the help of a photograph he took before leaving France.
The reception I have had from the French people has just been magnificent. These people show tremendous appreciation for what we did. And so we owe them something, too.
Kunkel's friend is no longer alive, but his great-grandson, Dominique Legrand, recalls growing up hearing tales about Kunkel from his grandmother, who met him when she was just 14.
Nous étions fiers de lui, fiers de le retrouver.
He says they're proud of him, that he's part of the family, and when they're together, Kunkel is like a grandfather. Dominique Legrand's 12-year-old son, Paul, now learns firsthand about the legacy of the men and women of D-Day.
C'est bien avec les vétérans.
L'histoire.
Oui, l'histoire.
Paul says it's great with the veterans, and that knowing the history is moving. Throughout the region, you can see posters of young people saying, "We are all 70. Tomorrow, the beaches will host President Obama, Queen Elizabeth, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. They'll all memorialize the soldiers who fought and the hundreds of thousands of people who died during the Battle of Normandy.
You know, American was at its finest hour, in my opinion. And maybe we're going back there.
For the world, I'm Jake Saganero in Le Combe, Normandy.
As we just heard, tomorrow's D-Day commemorations in France will be attended by both President Obama and Russia's Vladimir Putin. Could be an awkward moment given recent tensions between Moscow and Washington. But it's also odd because when we think of D-Day, we think of British and American troops landing in Normandy. The Russians, under the Soviet Union flag then, played no role. But then again, that's our perspective.
The Russians would certainly point out that they were very busy pushing back the Nazis on the Eastern Front. And in fact, some of the very decisive battles from the Soviet point of view in Stalingrad and Kursk had already taken place a year earlier. So the Russians have their own side of this story, which is on the Eastern Front.
That's reporter Charles Maines in Moscow.
You know, it's also really worth pointing out the fact that the D-Day, the idea of D-Day, was in fact part of the Kremlin's appeal to open up a second front in France just to ease the pressure on the Soviet forces as they were pushing back the Nazis. So in some ways, you know, the D-Day events were tied to the Eastern Front as well.
Yeah, I don't think it's hyperbole to say that in America, many of us know nothing about Russia's involvement in the war, and it does to us seem like D-Day was the be-all and end-all. I wonder if that historical event impacts today's politics at all.
You know, I think it does. It's part of this sort of feeling of being slighted. I think it's a little bit of a legacy of the Cold War, frankly, in the way that we've played up in Western textbooks and Russian textbooks, the role of separate armies. And, you know, I think that's coming together. Certainly, you know, information's out there if you want to read it. But I've had many conversations with Russians over the years where they've said to me essentially, you know, why don't you recognize our achievements and our involvement in World War II? And I think that just kind of lingers out there.
So Putin, though, appearing at a D-Day ceremony does seem a bit odd.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think in general, there's sort of a sense that the West has somehow not played up the role of the Soviet forces in pushing back the Nazis. And at the same time, I think it's more about Putin's participating in these Western clubs. He wants to be there in Normandy, and he wants to be part of this. Obviously, we've seen the G7 meetings over the past couple of days where Putin was excluded. And I think from the Russians' point of view, this is an important sort of masking over some of the events we've seen in Ukraine, where a little bit of all is forgiven at last.
Now, this is coming up not just because of the D-Day anniversary, but President François Hollande said he's not going to cut off relations with Russia, in part because of what Russia did during that war.
That's right. Mr. Hollande said that, you know, we can't ignore what the Russians had contributed to this, and this will always sort of link our two societies. And, you know, maybe this is the beginning of something that will begin to kind of paper over some of these fractures we've seen. You know, what will happen tomorrow is tough to say. You know, will they find ways to have some informal talks about the situation in Ukraine? You know, will the storyline be that Obama slighted Putin? But I do suspect that in Russian state media, they'll certainly show that post-Crimea, you know, despite all this talk of Russia's isolation, Putin is back at the table with world leaders.
Is D-Day marked at all in Russia?
It is not.
And what is the Russian D-Day?
For the Russians, the big day is May 9th. This is Victory Day. And it's really one of their most sacred holidays. But, you know, there has been this sort of shift in tone. I think in some ways Vladimir Putin has kind of co-opted Victory Day in recent years. It was notable this year he flew down to Crimea to meet with Russian forces there. And that was very symbolic given the fact that, you know, the Russians have been claiming that in post-Maidan independent Ukraine, the new government in Kiev is essentially a fascist government. And so Putin's statements that, you know, Russia will forever stand against fascism seem to resonate there.
You know, Charles, I'm embarrassed to say that I really don't know much about Russia's involvement in that war. And I hope that's an indication of poor history training in my country rather than my own ignorance.
You know, I think it's that basically, if you grow up in the U.S., you know, we learn about D-Day. Well, you know, there were these other events that kind of basically started the Nazi retreat from Soviet territory and eventually from Western Europe as well. And so the Russians, you know, they have a real case to make. If you look at some of the decisive battles from the Soviet period, this is in Stalingrad, this is in Kursk, this is the defense of Moscow, frankly, you know, these were important battles in this story.
That's Charles Maines, who's reported for years from Moscow. I want to go back to D-Day itself for a few minutes. On the 70th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy, we're seeing a lot of pictures from that historic day. Some of the most powerful pictures I've seen are in a Then and Now series put together by Getty Images. Photographer Peter McDermott took the Now photos to match exactly some of the historical pictures. Peter, start, if you would, by telling us where you are now and then why you took this series of photos.
Okay, well, I'm standing in a hilltop position where we've just witnessed a mass parachute jump near Ranville in Normandy in France. And with the internet, we decided to try and do a historic match-up with some of the archive collections of images taken from the last century. So you see what it looked like in 1944, for instance, with this material. And then you click on the image and you see the image change to exactly what it looks like in 2040. Really as a way of allowing viewers to interact with history.
And was it hard for you to track down the exact locations of the original photos?
I had a bit of modern technology help in the shape of Google Street View, believe it or not. I went through all the images and looked for reference points in the original archive images from 1944 that may still be there. So buildings, bridges, and then using Street View on my laptop, I was able to see whether it was worth a visit to Normandy.
Now, some of the most stunning images are actually looking out toward the sea where there aren't those landmarks that you can match up.
Sure, and Omaha Beach, for instance, which is a very wide shot with lots of landing craft and ships and barrage balloons, that could be within maybe half a mile. The other image you're referring to, I think there's a couple of images of Marines, I think, coming ashore. And the 2014 picture literally is just sand and a wave.
Right.
That was on Gold Beach, which is the beach that the British military attacked on the 6th of June, 1944. So again, that's within maybe even a few hundred meters.
I'm always stunned by how we have these incredible, iconic pictures and absolutely no understanding or no knowledge of who took them.
Well, I can only imagine how difficult it must have been to work in such dangerous conditions. And in fact, I think some of the images are taken by soldiers. There is one image that is the British soldiers going ashore from a landing craft. The photographer of that is known.
Yeah, this is Lieutenant Hanford is the picture you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, and in fact, that's a famous image that's well published. There's a colonel of the regiment in the water, and he's taking with him his personal piper, bagpipe player. And he goes ashore.
Right.
And I think there was recently a statue unveiled to the colonel.
Are there images, do you think, that you'll have taken in your career that will end up being iconic as some of these, and perhaps the picture you're talking about?
I'd like to think so. I'd hope so. But I have very limited experience of combat, I have to say. But I wouldn't want to experience what some of those photographers went through 70 years ago.
I look at some of these pictures and all I can think is terror.
Yes, being able to function at all, photographer as a viewer or a soldier being there, I'm not sure I could function at all with that much fear. In fact, when I was doing the modern day pictures to match up with the archive pictures, I found it fascinating to be standing sometimes perhaps within a couple of meters of a photographer or a soldier with a camera from 70 years ago in the case of the D-Day material. I found that absolutely incredible to think that there was someone doing the exact same thing as me, but all that time ago, in exactly the same place. And it sounds slightly cheesy maybe, but standing in the footsteps of history was exactly what it was. And at times it was very moving and quite haunting as well.
That's Getty Images photographer Peter McDermott. He produced a Then and Now slideshow of D-Day images. The three-year-old nation of South Sudan is facing a crisis, actually a few crises. Fighting between rival internal factions that began last December has killed thousands of people. The fighting has also displaced some 1.3 million South Sudanese. Many now face the risk of famine in coming months, and there's a new cholera outbreak. Nancy Lindborg was recently in South Sudan. Lindborg is USAID's Assistant Administrator for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. Ms. Lindborg, first tell us, when were you there and what was the situation like on the ground?
Thanks, Aaron. I was in Juba and a little bit north in Bor in South Sudan about a month or so ago and had a chance to talk with a number of people who had been displaced by the violence, many of whom are living in very crowded conditions, huddled for protection in the UN compounds, which we're very concerned about as the rains come, will be partly underwater. This is one of the reasons that we're watching very closely the possibility of cholera outbreaks that you mentioned, because the sanitation is very poor.
The U.S. recently pledged $300 million in humanitarian aid to South Sudan. That sounds like an awful lot of money. Is that enough?
That is nowhere near enough. We pledged that as part of an international conference that was held in Norway. At the end of the conference, there was $600 million raised, but much more is needed. I mean, you mentioned the number of people who have been displaced, Aaron, and that's as if everybody in Boston plus one friend had to flee their houses, many of whom left urban areas to go into very remote, hard-to-reach rural areas. And also, almost 500,000 of those people had to go into flood-prone areas. And now as the rains come, they're trapped.
Nancy, explain what $600 million goes to buy.
It's food. It's seeds, so that there's some hope of getting a crop in. It's urgent medical assistance to stave off things like cholera.
Nancy Lindborg, this is the inevitable question. Why do we need to spend this amount of money? Why do we need a stable South Sudan? Why is it in the U.S. interest?
You know, South Sudan is the world's newest nation, and we, the United States, have been closely supportive of the people of South Sudan for almost 20 years as they fought a war for independence. South Sudan has the potential to very much take care of itself with agriculture, with oil revenues. What you have right now are leaders who are choosing their own political gain over the welfare of their people.
But why is it important that this country is stable? I appreciate it's a good thing. But as far as American interest goes, what is the American interest? Is it oil? Is it something else?
The interest is, if you look across the globe, when you have failed states that are actively in conflict, you have a greater potential for all of the concerns that arise with ungoverned space, whether it's extremist elements or disease flows across borders. There's very much a security interest in having stability around the world. And it also matters from a moral perspective. It matters to all of us that children in South Sudan are at risk of famine. We talk about 1 million people who are at risk of famine. That's like more than the population of San Francisco at risk of starving to death.
As you know, one of the problems often with these humanitarian endeavors is that money is pledged, but it's pretty hard to actually get out there and use. Are you confident that these hundreds of millions of dollars will get to the people who need it?
I'm very confident. Having visited out there, we are working with UN and NGO partners who are very, very experienced. The challenge is making sure that those avenues remain possible, that we have the ability to use rivers, roads, and the airways. And for that, we need both sides to this conflict to continue to allow that to happen. We have the first barge going next week because the river has been closed due to fighting. So we're hopeful that there's additional access now that will enable us to get out to these difficult areas.
Nancy Lindborg is with USAID. She recently returned from a trip to South Sudan. Nancy, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Aaron.
This summer, Lego women are leaning in, well, as best they can lean without feet. Lego is planning to launch a new line featuring Lego female scientists. The series includes an astronomer with a telescope, a paleontologist with a dinosaur skeleton, and a chemist in a lab. And none of these Lego ladies wear pink. The collection was designed and submitted to the Danish toy company by Ellen Koyman. She's an isotope geochemist in Stockholm. She's also a huge Lego fan. Koyman came up with the toy set as part of the Lego Ideas campaign. Enthusiasts can submit and vote on ideas for sets they want to see sold in toy stores. When a project receives 10,000 votes, it's reviewed by a board of set designers and marketing representatives. After testing the concepts for stability, playability, safety, and market fit, the board selects one idea to become the next Lego product. Kooyman's female science set will be marketed as the Research Institute Collection. Emily Grossman is a molecular biologist who now teaches science. She's seen pictures of the Lego prototypes.
I think it's just brilliant that there's these depictions of women doing science jobs, finally, in these little Lego figurines. If you think about as a child, you don't ask questions what goes on around you. You look at what's in front of you and you absorb that into your consciousness. So children will now be growing up absorbing the fact that it's just as common and just as cool and just as interesting for women to be doing these classically male-represented, dominated science jobs.
Lego has been criticized in the past for its gender-based marketing. The company created a set of building blocks in 2011 geared for girls called Lego Friends. It featured thin female figurines that lock into pastel-painted settings, such as a beauty salon and a bakery. But these new science figurines have been criticized, too, for making the women look a little, well, manly.
People have been commenting, oh, you know, they've got bums on their heads and they just look a little bit sort of conservative. But of course they do. I mean, if you're working in a chemistry lab, as anyone knows, and I did in my PhD, then you do have to look neat and tidy. You have to have your hair pulled back. You have to look that nothing's in the way. But then, of course, you take it off and you let your hair down and you look sexy and feminine in the evenings.
In her project proposal, creator Ellen Kooyman wrote, "The motto of these scientists is clear. Explore the world and beyond." When her female scientist set is released later this year, Kooyman will receive a cut of the sales. Now that is leaning in. If you want to see Kooyman's design, we have it online, PRI.org. And this is The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Coming up, the enduring image of Tiananmen Square's Tank Man.
He stands down this tank. He moves. He doesn't let the tank go around him. He climbs on. He climbs off. It's so unbelievable when you see it.
We'll hear how that image from 1989 is now used in political satire all around the globe. That ahead on The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Imagine you're a kid trying to make the perilous journey across the U.S.-Mexico border without documents and without parents. That's happening more and more. We're talking tens of thousands of kids crossing on their own each year. Last year alone, 24,000 were caught. Susan Cruz tries to help these children once they're in the U.S. in custody. Cruz is a dual citizen of the U.S. and El Salvador. Now she testifies as an expert witness in cases involving undocumented minors.
More kids are coming. Air Force bases are being opened up to house these children because the shelters that generally hold them are up to capacity. One of the main drivers that's pushing these kids out of their home countries is the crime and violence that is almost unchecked by the governments of these countries. For example, Honduras, which is not in an armed conflict, has the highest homicide rate per capita in the world. Not in the region, in the world.
We'd like you to tell us about a few undocumented immigrant kids that you personally have tried to help. Let's start first with a girl you called Beatrice or Betty. You met her when she was 12 years old. She lived in a Salvadoran town called Cajutepeque.
Yes. So Betty was being approached by this young man who was involved in a gang. He was trying to persuade her to be his girlfriend, and Betty's 12 years old, and she was going to school and had no interest in this guy. So she tried to stay away from him and made it clear to him that she didn't want to be his girlfriend. And so he took some of his fellow gang members to threaten her and her grandmother with whom she lived. They slipped a note under the grandmother's door stating that they were going to kidnap Betty, rape her, and eventually kill her if she didn't comply. When the grandmother saw that the threat was real, and having talked to other adults in the community, including reaching out to the police told them that there was nothing that they could do, that it was an anonymous threat. So the grandmother, not being satisfied and not wanting to wait until something did happen, Betty was sent to the United States.
And she was caught at the border or no?
Yes, she was. And she was put into one of the shelters where undocumented unaccompanied minors are placed.
And you testified on her behalf. What happened then?
I stated that I did believe that it was true that she was in a position to be threatened and that there was a very high probability that she would be killed or raped if returned to El Salvador, and that the state is in a position where it cannot act proactively to protect children. One thing I want to make clear, when people think of foster care and child welfare and child protection here in the United States, this does not exist in these countries.
On that note, if you could tell me about a boy you call Eric.
Eric was a teenager in Honduras whose father worked at a bank and was being extorted by the local police because he worked in a bank. So the police would randomly pick up Eric when he was walking home from school, when he was hanging out with his friends in his neighborhood, and they would arrest him and take him to the police station. And then they would summon the father to come in and pay, quote unquote, a fine. So Eric's father began to realize that he was being extorted and decided not to pay. So what the police did is they took a 16-year-old Eric and they put him in a man's prison. His father had to pay basically a ransom, the extortion fee, to the police to get Eric out of the men's prison. And what he did is he sent him to California. However, in California, he had no family there, and Eric got in trouble with the law. And that's where I met him. He would participate in my psychoeducational groups in a juvenile detention facility in Los Angeles County. He told me his story, and I connected him with other people that could help him. So we were able to find an attorney, and we even brought a retired police commissioner from Honduras who could corroborate what had happened to Eric. However, the immigration judge declined to hear her testimony, and Eric was being harassed in the detention facility south of San Diego where he was being held. One time he was handcuffed for 18 hours, and the guards said, you know, that they couldn't find the keys. So more and more he was being pressured to sign a voluntary departure, and Eric couldn't stand it anymore, and that's eventually what he did. He lost hope, and he was sent back to Honduras, and he was eventually killed.
Do we know who killed him?
There are many theories, but the police have not found someone responsible for his murder. As a matter of fact, less than 20% of homicides in Honduras are resolved.
Susan, what is the way out of this situation where Central American kids face a choice of being swept into this criminal underworld or making a dangerous and illegal journey on their own? What do we do?
First and foremost, I think that we have to look at what's happening in their home countries and try to address what are the voids, what's missing, why isn't there anyone around protecting these children and youth, and why is it when something bad happens to them, people have acquiesced to the fact that this is just the way things are. I think there's something very wrong with that, and I think that's where we should start.
Susan Cruz is a forensic social worker who has testified as an expert witness in cases involving undocumented minors. Susan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The border between California and Mexico at San Ysidro is the busiest border crossing in the world. An estimated 90,000 people pass through there each day. Just picture sitting in that traffic as part of your daily commute. Many Americans are increasingly doing that. They work in the U.S. by day, then drive home to Mexico at night. Reporter Akiko Fujita made the trip with one committed commuter.
We should be across the border in less than 5 minutes from here.
Gil Devine sets his radio to country music as he patiently maneuvers his way through Interstate 5. He assures me this is a light traffic day.
You know what? It's no big deal. It's nothing out of the ordinary for me.
Nothing out of the ordinary until you see a massive Mexican flag, armed border guards, and 24 kiosks at the port of entry with hundreds of cars funneling through.
We got a green light, so we don't have to stop for anything. We're gone.
Devine's been making this cross-border commute for 11 years now, crossing into the U.S. where he works as a yacht broker in San Diego 6 days a week, crossing back over to Mexico where he lives with his wife and two kids.
I leave my house anywhere between 7 o'clock and like 8 o'clock normally. And I get to my office anywhere between like 8:30 and 9. So it's not that bad.
Devine used to live in the U.S., But in 2004, he traveled to Mexico with his now ex-wife to look for a beachfront vacation home. He ended up here in the Real del Mar community, about 15 miles from San Ysidro. His three-bedroom house overlooking the ocean cost just $140,000, a fraction of what it would have cost in the U.S.
It would be 10 times the amount. There's nothing with a good ocean view in California for less than $1 million or $2 million. There's nothing.
Divine loved this neighborhood so much that within months he decided to live here full time. Now he's got company. Realtor Gustavo Torres in Rosarito says he's been getting a lot of calls from American homebuyers lately, and he appreciates that. 5 years ago, when the housing bubble burst here, he says the neighborhood looked like a ghost town.
Vacant, vacant, vacant for rent, for rent, for rent. But now everything's rented. We have a Dairy Queen, McDonald's, Martin Final. We have the same beach, the same climate. Everything's the same, but the price is a lot lower. And also the cost of living is a lot lower.
Improvements at the San Ysidro Crossing have made the U.S.-Mexico commute easier. This fall, the port of entry will expand to 64 traffic lanes and booths. And you can apply for a Sentry Pass, a card that lets you take the fast lane across the border. Torres says Americans are arriving because they've heard Mexico's crime rates are coming down after years of drug war violence.
They feel safe again because the perception of insecurity started disappearing once Americans came and talked to their friends and tell them that it was really safe.
These days, he says 60% of homebuyers in Baja are American.
So this is our living room, and this is our dining room and kitchen area.
Many, like Gene Figueroa and his wife, are opting for the three-month trial, renting a beachfront condo first before taking the plunge into ownership. The couple moved here from Orange County.
It was always my dream to be able to live on the beach. And growing up in Southern California, as the population increased, I couldn't afford to even live anywhere near the ocean.
The cost of living may be good here, but Gil Devine admits life in Mexico has its challenges. The roads aren't all paved, making for a rocky commute. And there aren't many well-paying jobs. You almost have to commute.
Hold on, sweetheart.
His still limited Spanish makes it tougher to communicate with his new Mexican wife and stepchildren. Still, like 50,000 other Americans who live in Baja now, Devine says he has no plans to leave.
A lot of my friends like to come down and visit. They love the area. They just don't have the guts to do it. And it's not a big deal, really. People think it's a major change, but it's really not.
It just means he has to cross the world's busiest border twice a day. For The World, I'm Akiko Fujita. Rosarito, Mexico.
Our next story takes us far from the U.S.-Mexico border to Iran. Specifically, we're going to find out more about a popular women's magazine there called Zanan. It's just started publishing again, but 6 years ago it was shuttered by Iran's government for, quote, threatening the psychological security of society. Here's Zanan's editor, Shala Sherkat, speaking to PBS in 2009, a year after the shutdown. Iran was then celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Republic.
The current government in Iran is always worried about a revolution, and it seems strange to me that people like bloggers, Zanan, women or other people in society are accused of plotting one. I'm not the only person who thinks this. We are many. If the government of Iran were mature, and it's the 30th anniversary now, they shouldn't have to worry and imprison or restrict people.
Maybe Iranian authorities are feeling more mature, more secure now, hence the decision to let this women's magazine publish again. Nina Ansari is an Iranian historian and an expert on Iran's women's movement. She has an upcoming book called The Jewels of Allah. Nina, tell us more about this magazine, Zanan.
Aaron, the magazine Zanan, which has been its resurgence right now under the banner Zanan Emruz, or Today's Women, was actually the longest running and most popular feminist publication in post-revolutionary Iran, which in and of itself is unique and unprecedented Ms. Sherkat was able to remain on the radar for so long within a patriarchal environment. Zanan was unique in many ways. One, it blurred the distinction between strictly Iranian and Western standards where the feminist terminology was concerned. In order for me to elaborate, I would want to have to go in back into the background of traditional women in Iran who, for the most part, felt that the feminist terminology is really a Western concept that is irrelevant to the nature of women's demands in Iran. And Sherkat uniquely contributed by showcasing the common ingredients between historically disempowered women in Western nations through an inventory of her articles about Simone de Beauvoir, about the words and wisdom of Virginia Woolf, all echoing the predicament of women in post-revolutionary Iran who continue to be debilitated by an ingrained custom of patriarchy.
This sounds like pretty heady stuff. There were no articles about makeup or dieting?
No,
that sort of thing?
This is exactly what is unique. What I found to be unique about Zenon was that Sherkat herself really emphasized the intellectual capacity of womanhood as opposed to her outward appearance. She had some fashion pages and also some pages on the art of cuisine, but, you know, those were very sporadic.
You know, sort of the message that we get about Iranian women here in the United States is that there's a lot of concern about outward appearance and looking good.
That is the concern of hardliners, is to dictate how a woman should look. And women in Iran right now are rebelling against an enforced dress code. There are women in Iran who probably still embrace wearing a head covering or the veil, but the enforcement of it has been so drastic that I think this is a form of rebellion right now, especially by Iran, where Iranian youth are concerned. And so, you know, what you see with women's outward appearance is really nothing to do with the educational attainment, their drive, their desire to have a career. Those are all things that Sherkat brought to the forefront in her magazine for 16 years and now has resurfaced to do the same.
Have you been able to read the first issue of the new magazine? What kind of stories were there? And does it have the same strength as the old magazine?
You know, Sherkat's stories reflect a strong yet cautious opening act, which is completely understandable. Her articles are not as bold as they were in Zenon. You're talking 16 years. When you're on the map for 16 years, it empowers you more. I think, given the fact that she has been absent for 6 years, I think this is a beautiful opening act. And it also shows the art of persistence, which for the women's movement in Iran is very important, the art of persistence.
Nina Ansari, author and historian, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're listening to The World. Fracking for natural gas is one of those technologies that's caused a real rift among environmentalists. Some see it as a key to weaning ourselves off dirty coal and fighting climate change. Others say it ravages the landscape and risks people's health. The debate that began here in the U.S. has exploded around the world, and this week it took a new and somewhat comic twist in Britain. Here's The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson.
Okay, guys, don't forget, today we've got a special job. We're off to frack the Prime Minister's house.
Greenpeace has pulled off some clever stunts over the years. And whatever you think of its politics, the one they staged this week at the country home of British Prime Minister David Cameron was classic guerrilla theater.
Well, I'm so glad David Cameron's not a NIMBY and he's letting us frack outside his own front door.
That's from a Greenpeace video showing off the group's early morning stunt setting up a bogus gas fracking site just feet from the door of the Prime Minister's house outside of London. The action was the latest volley in a long-running battle over fracking in the UK. And it came in response to seemingly inoffensive legislation announced by Queen Elizabeth this week in her annual address to Parliament.
The bill will enhance the United Kingdom's energy independence and security by opening up access to shale and geothermal sites.
Simple enough. But behind that opening up access to shale language, there's an effort by the government to change the laws about drilling for gas under people's homes.
The Prime Minister is going to open up over half of Britain to fracking companies. And so ahead of that, he's decided to strip homeowners of their right to object to drilling underneath their property.
That's Greenpeace spokesman Lawrence Carter. Under the new law, companies wouldn't need permission from homeowners to drill under their houses and land for shale oil and gas. That's what prompted the group to send a small contingent of hard-hatted activists to Cameron's cottage and set up fences with signs saying, "We apologize for any inconvenience caused while we frack under your home." Greenpeace points to surveys that it says shows three-quarters of Brits oppose the new move. Fracking has been associated with water contamination, methane leaks, and small earthquakes, but it's also brought an unprecedented boom in relatively clean natural gas. The British government wants to bring the technology to the UK, but they've run into widespread opposition, including from thousands of homeowners who've withheld permission to drill under their properties. But Britain today is highly dependent on natural gas, and other domestic supplies of the stuff are playing out. So says Ken Cronin of the industry organization called the UK Onshore Operators Group.
83% of our homes currently get heated by gas. That gas, by 2030, will come from Qatar, Russia, and other places.
Cronin points out that the gas under British territory is commonly owned. But Prime Minister Cameron insists no one will see frackers just show up outside their homes.
What those who are anti-getting shale gas seem to be claiming is that somehow it'll be legal to go onto someone's property and frack against their will. That is simply not the case.
But it seems that what the new legislation would allow is for horizontal wells to be drilled under people's property from nearby sites. Fracking opponents say the question of permission is hardly the only issue. They object to the technology in principle. Among other things, they say it can poison water supplies.
When are the chemicals arriving? Who's got the chemicals?
After setting up their faux drilling operation and shooting their video outside Cameron's home, the Greenpeace activists were shooed away by local police, about which a Greenpeace spokesman said, "We have to say the police have a point. You shouldn't be allowed to just turn up outside someone's home and start fracking under their garden without their permission." For the World, I'm Peter Thompson.
Finally, today we want to zero in on an iconic image from 25 years ago. I'm talking about the lone man facing down an army tank in Tiananmen Square, the Tank Man. It's the image we most associate with China's brutal 1989 crackdown against student protesters. It might surprise you to know that many Chinese today haven't ever seen it. That's because their government has successfully banned it from circulation since 1989. Users of the Twitter-like site Weibo, for example, are blocked from searching the terms tank and tank man. Outside China, it's a different story. The World's Carol Hills has been tracking how the image of the tank man has permeated popular culture. Carol, where do you see the tank man?
You see it in everything. You see it in advertisements, protest movements. I follow political cartoons. And, you know, it's just such a powerful image when you look at the original photo and or the video that we all saw back in 1989. This guy is sort of, he stands down this tank. He moves. He doesn't let the tank go around him. He climbs on. He climbs off. It's just, it's so unbelievable when you see it. When I see it in political cartoons, it's used to convey everything from, you know, Angela Merkel is the lone person standing down Vladimir Putin in a tank, to a European farmer standing there in front of the tank, and the barrel of the tank is an ear of genetically modified corn. I mean, you just see it to convey every kind of standoff that looks kind of impossible but may just work. So it's sort of amazing. It comes up in satirical ways in things like The Simpsons. There was an episode of The Simpsons in 2007 where they recreate that scene. They're visiting Beijing. They're adopting a baby. But at one point, Homer Simpson is trying to get a cab. So he faces down this cab, and he won't let it past him, and he wants the cab, and he shuffles around. So it's humorous, but interestingly, they name the episode of that. They used a kind of weird version of the old pinyin system of the characters, of transliterating the characters. And so it's enough that it got by, but it sort of means Tiananmen. So they slipped in little political messages, but it was very funny, too.
You know, it is such a powerful image, this David and Goliath moment. It's really hard to believe that this hasn't made its way back to China.
Clearly, in the digital age, it snuck its way back in. And I'm sure, you know, lots of people in China have seen it. But there is concern that a whole generation of people have grown up and really don't know this image because the Chinese government has been hugely effective at blocking it. I mean, even now, you can't search Tank Man or Tank, you know, on Weibo. You know, it's just blocked. So it's seeped in I follow a couple Chinese cartoonists. Some are in exile. Some are in China using pen names. And they'll use it. You know, one great one was, you know, the lone person is the Twitter bird. And the tanks are replaced by characters from Angry Birds. So you see sort of satirical takes. Last year, a guy in Hong Kong recreated the photo and it showed the man. And the tanks were these rubber ducks. It was a takeoff on this giant rubber duck, which had been created and floated in Hong Kong Harbor. And it went on Weibo, and then it was immediately off. So it just, you know, they sneak them in, but they don't last very long.
Now, as you say, the image of the tank man has made its way all over the world. Do we know anything about the man himself?
No one knows what happened to him. There's all sorts of theories. Whole documentaries have been produced trying to find out. Barbara Walters famously confronted the former Chinese leader Jiang Zemin. What happened to him? And Jiang Zemin was flustered but could only say, we don't know. We only know that that tank didn't kill him. But no one knows if he died, if he's in exile. No one knows.
You can see that iconic image as well as other political cartoons using that iconic image and a bit of that Simpsons episode at PRI.org. Thanks as always, Carol.
Thanks, Aaron.
That's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Aaron Schachter. Thanks as always for tuning in.